My name is Paul Menzel. This is the second in a series on some moral questions about healthcare policy. And the topic for today is a question about allocating scarce resources within healthcare, namely the dilemma between prevention and cure. That's often stated as the dilemma between prevention and medicine. But sometimes we talk about preventive medicine, so the terms get linked, and I'd rather talk about the distinction between prevention and cure. What I really mean by cure, however, is the whole locus of cure and care. Sometimes we call that treatment. For a person who's already in trouble. And prevention is nipping things in the bud before you get in trouble. That's the distinction. Now let me review just a bit of yesterday. Well, I definitely have more time for discussion today. Also, raise questions as I'm going along. My usual format in making presentations is not to divide sharply between presentation and discussion. So feel free to raise questions as you go along. Yesterday, I noted that many people have analyzed the medical care economy as having a blank check, primarily because of insurance. Insurance gives both patients and providers a blank check on resources. The only inhibition is increasing premiums for the insurance. Now that is going to create the best possible medical care system. No, if you want to structure the economic incentives so you get the best possible medical care, that's the way to do it. But the question that comes out of that is, just as the best possible defense system is perhaps a monster because it can eat up too many of our resources, even if you agree with all the goals of defense, so also isn't the best possible medical care system, given the amount of resources it can eat up, something of a monster. Now, I'm not saying that we're there yet. I'm raising the issue. I don't want to say that at a particular, okay, now here's an example of something which is excess in the system. I want to raise the issues. And I want to raise the issues because I think they're going to be raised anyhow. And unless thoughtful people, rather than just bureaucrats, start getting involved in the policy thinking process, if other people besides bureaucrats start getting involved in the policy thinking process, we're going to be better off as a society. Now, to make the issue significant, I think you have to argue that life has a price, because otherwise you don't know, you wouldn't put any cutoff on when healthcare was costing too much for the benefits it gave. The only question you'd be concerned about is, does it give some benefits? And I argued that life does have a price. Let me just quickly review the elements in arguing that it does. First of all, we're generally focusing on a risk reduction case, not a question where it's for sure no life at all without the treatment, or for sure a lot of life with the treatment. Occasionally you get that case, and I think even there you can argue that there's a price on life, but it's much more problematic to argue in that circumstance that there is. But most of the things we do in healthcare are risk reduction. There are a few that are not. Kidney dialysis is probably one of the clearest ones that is not. Often appendectomies are cited as ones where it's not a matter of risk reduction, but that's problematic. If you talk to a physician about when an active appendectomy should be done, you find out that there very often aren't clear signs of whether or not it's appendicitis problem that's causing the symptoms or whether it's something else. And so there are actually long, elaborate articles in the medical journals about what the chances are, given a certain set of symptoms, of it being appendicitis, so that when you operate to remove the appendix, you're really going to do some good. It could be that it's something else, and so when you operate, you aren't doing any good. In fact, you're just exposing the patient to the risk of the operation without any good, and then you get calculations about what exactly the symptoms have to be to make the probabilities such that you probably ought to risk the operation. It's still a somewhat probability-loaded case. But kidney dialysis is generally not. Without kidney dialysis, some people know for sure that they're going to die. With it, they don't know for sure they're going to live, but their chances are something like 95% of surviving the first year. Again, certain complications could get so bad that they wouldn't. But in that case, we tend not to put we tend to have much more serious reservations about putting a price on life. In risk reduction cases, however, I think we can argue that life does have a price. Why does it have a price? It has a price because by price we mean monetary price, and money is simply that which we can use on various resources. It's the convertible item. You can't use food to cure yourself when you've got an appendicitis, but you can use money on either food or medical care. Money, by definition, is that which can buy various goods in the economy. So if we're going to make any trade-offs at all between other things in life that we want and reducing risks of death and risks of ill health, we are putting a monetary price on life by the very definition of monetary price. Now, if you want to remove people's freedom to make those trades, then you would be saying life doesn't have a monetary price. But who wants to remove people's freedom to make those trades? I just don't think generally we do. Except maybe in cases where life clearly is going to be lost if you don't treat, clearly will be saved if you do. There, maybe we don't want to make any trades. And that's why we say life has no price in that case. But as I said, I think maybe even there it does. Well, at any rate, just to look at a couple of figures. These figures will come later. The range that people looking for indicators in our behavior and also using questionnaires, you know, what will people trade for what? The range that is usually thrown around in the literature now, the last couple of years, is $100,000 to $1 million per life. Seems to be what people indicate is their trade-off range. One of the ways you get this is by looking at labor market data. What extra salary do people require to take a very risky job? And you get a range of, one of the articles comes up with a range of 200 to 500,000 for those workers. Well, you probably have, or no, it's lower than that. That's something like 50,000 to 200,000. Now, what you really have to do is inflate that to see what the range would be for most people, because the people working on skyscrapers are likely to be the least risk-averse people. They won't be willing to pay as much to avoid a risk as other people will. They're more willing, they're more risk willing. The average one of us would have to have more extra salary than they would ask for to work on a skyscraper. And so then the estimate is, this is a safe estimate. We had a lot of figures in between. In terms of what people's actual behavior reveals their range to be. And this is what it turns out to be in life years. Now, this is all gonna come into play in the prevention cure discussion too, so this is not just review. One item I didn't know last time was the Pinto car safety case that was so much in the news. Have you all heard about the lawsuit that Ford Motor Company ran into? Ford Motor Company was sued because it did not put a gas tank improvement on the Pinto car 1 year when their designers had actually come up with the improvement. The reason they didn't is the improvement cost $11 per car to redesign the tank. And they computed it out. Well, no, it was just more money. And they didn't. The suit was by some people who had their car explode in flames because of the unsafe gas tank. Several people lost their lives, and relatives of the people victims sued. Now, it's interesting that though it's debatable whether Ford Motor Company really went through these calculations, the ones that would have justified their decision not to put on the improvement. But, so after the fact, they're justifying their behavior by saying, well, it computes out the $11 improvement, computes out to $200,000 per life saved, which is, you know, right in the range. And if, in fact, this is a very low-risk decision, you're reducing a very low risk, even slightly lower, by this gas tank improvement. It's not a 1 in 500 risk of losing your life if you don't do the improvement. It's a 1 in 50,000 chance, and you're reducing it to 1 in 100,000 or something like that. Even lower than that, probably. In extremely low-risk situations, the valuation people put on lives tends to be in the lower end of this range. So Ford Motor Company could have argued very persuasively that the $200,000 price was too high to pay for that safety improvement, just in terms of what people's actual choices are. Now, you can still say, well, people should have had the choice as consumers as to whether to put on that improvement or not. Well, it would have been higher than 11 if you could only put it on some cars as optional. It might have been $50 per improvement if you hadn't done it to every car. So, and maybe hardly anybody would have bought it for $50. So maybe Ford Motor Company was perfectly justified in not putting on that improvement. Well, other people say, but my gosh, look at the victims. Look at the victims. There's no difference there. No matter how low the risk was, it eventually hit somebody, and then you got such a tragedy, shouldn't we be perfectly willing to spend even much more than $200,000 per life saved on the safety improvement? Well, the discussion goes on, and there are all kinds of other legal questions in the Pinto case, which I don't want to get into. I just throw it in as a figure. It fits in this range. Dialysis fits right in this range. Notice it's right in the middle of that range. It's probably still a good buy. In terms of other, if you compare it with other choices people make about safety improvements. Okay, now, if you're concerned about costs, and if you're concerned about the lives that are saved and the lives that are lost, many critics of the present American medical system say we're spending far too little money on prevention, far too much on cure. We have elaborate hospitals, but we have relatively unaggressive, there's still a lot of prevention, a lot of emphasis on prevention, but it's rather unaggressive emphasis on prevention. So, for example, we have passed up, you can go to the particular studies, which show that we have passed up instituting a test sort of universally for people, some kind of screening program, which would be widely known among doctors so they'd know who it should be done on whom it should be done. We've passed up a test for cervical cancer. One study showed that we passed up a test for cervical cancer because it came out costing $30,000 per life saved, but we use CAT scanners, and when their average computes out to maybe $400,000 per life saved. Now, isn't that just stupid? Isn't that just stupid? To spend less money per life saved, if you compute it out that way, on prevention than on cure. Now, of course, the test that might nip cervical cancer in the bud way before it begins to show any normal symptoms, would be given to people who don't think they're in trouble. So they aren't sitting there pleading for help at all. It's a screening test. CAT scans are done on people who are in trouble. And then the question comes up, is the fact that one person is in trouble and another person is not in trouble justify spending far less per life saved on the preventive case, and far more on the treatment, cure case? If our focus is on the lives saved, how can there be a difference? What difference does it make whether you die of cervical cancer because you didn't have this screening test back when you didn't know whether you'd have the disease or not, or whether you die because, though you're in trouble, there are no CAT scanners around? What difference does it make? You got two people that are dead, same tragedies in the family, et cetera, et cetera. So isn't, in fact, our whole the orientation of our American medical system callous, inconsiderate of the actual lives that are at stake? Now, there are plenty of explanations of why, sort of cynical explanations of why we have put the emphasis on treatment that we have. By emphasis, let me define emphasis here. If I say priority on treatment, cure or emphasis on treatment cure. What I mean is that we're willing to spend more dollars per life saved on that than on prevention. And what I mean by equivalence, if I say equivalence, that priority and cure are equivalent, morally equivalent, what I mean is the claim that we should spend the same number of dollars per life saved on both prevention and treatment. Those who are cynical about our medical economy's emphasis on cure say, priority on cure, say, well, it's because you can make money giving people curative treatment, but you can't make much money giving them prevention. After all, curative treatment is just much more expensive. The very fact that it costs more per life saved is why it's emphasized. That's why. Especially in a system where consumers don't have, because of lack of competition, don't have control over choices of resources. Also, it is said the emphasis and priority for treatment over prevention protects certain very large institutional interests. For example, it's the fact that we've been talked into thinking or led somehow culturally into thinking that prevention is morally less important than curing a person already in trouble, that we don't think Kellogg cereals is really very responsible for all the sugar it puts in cereals. And so some company is not completely responsible for occupational workplace safety standards. Mining companies aren't as responsible as they perhaps should be for preventing mine disasters. So that's the cynical criticism of the present arrangement. There is a more cogent moral criticism. It's not just cynically cite political interests. Cynically, I don't use as a bad word here. I just mean, there's a moral case that some want to make rather than a political case against the current arrangement. It is simply that morally, if we look at the situation, as I said before, how can the life lost because we didn't have a preventive program be worth any less than the life lost because we didn't have a certain treatment program? How can it be worth any less? Now, I've given you some of the intuitions behind saying we should move more toward prevention and make the two equivalent. There is, however, in all of us, a very strong intuition the other way. It's hard to put our finger on in a certain way, especially when we get to examining it in more detail. It has something to do with the distinction between statistical and identifiable lives. It seems that morally, if a person is in trouble and calling on us for help, isn't that just simply more important? And therefore, it warrants more money per life saved than the call of somebody who's barely calling, because it's only prevention that they want. Even if it's not self-help prevention, even if it's prevention like the cervical cancer test that has to be given by a healthcare provider, isn't the call of somebody who doesn't know he or she is in trouble just morally a less urgent call? Much less urgent call. It's a much less urgent call because they are not identified as the individual who's likely to lose their life, whereas the person who's in trouble is already an identifiable person, an identifiable death, a potential identifiable death, close to it. And that's and to cut back on money by saying we're not going to spend more resources on medical care if it's only statistical, so-called statistical lives that are at stake, which is largely the case in prevention, that's not treating people callously. But the cut back on money when they're already in trouble and know that it's they who might lose their life, isn't that an assault on the dignity of life? Yes. Well, it's very hard to say what has caused what. It's possible that there are more things now, environmental things, stress factors in the way we live, etc., which cause people, once they get to 50, to be more likely to die than 200 years ago. But, though we've only increased 3 years once you get to 50, in the last 200 years. Medicine has really done about 7 or 8 or 10 years of the increase, because otherwise we would have dropped 10 years. That could be. I don't know. It's just very hard to figure out. Those calculations are very, very hard to make. We could plug in the price of health as well as the price of life in this discussion. I think it would be fairly parallel. People are still going to make trade-offs. And you still have the question, if the marginal benefits of a particular new treatment or a particular way of delivering certain care are very slight, such that given the money they cost, the value per life saved or value per health increment, if we got down to that, is a certain dollar figure. Should we be using that treatment? And the claim of people who want to emphasize a moral case for cure as warranting more money per unit of benefit, life, health, whatever it is, than prevention, is that when you abstain or restrain yourself from curative care of people already in trouble, who know they're in trouble, you are assaulting the dignity of the individual more than if you restrain costs in preventive care. And therefore, though we could increase our health indicators, improve our health indicators statistically, more by taking the money we're presently using on treatment and shifting at least some of it, a sizable chunk of it, into prevention, morally that would be bad. Even though the results would turn out better, morally it would be bad. Because we would be leaving certain people who are in trouble and know they're in trouble as individuals to die. Whereas if we keep it the way it is and have less priority on prevention, I'm assuming that we can make educated guesses about the actual results. So, and you're right, in an educational preventive program, the results are much less clear. All we got is a range. Even after some experience, all we've got is a range because of the complexity of knowing what has caused what. But nevertheless, given what figures we can get, given what estimates we can make about what the effects of a preventive program are going to be, should we start our thinking with the assumption that we don't need to spend as many dollars per benefit unit on prevention as we need to spend, morally should spend, on cure of people already in trouble? If we should spend more on cure than on prevention, then one very major criticism of the present American medical system falls flat, namely the criticism that a whole lot of people are making money off of cure, which they couldn't make off of prevention, or spending a lot more money per unit gained on cure than on prevention. Okay, I'd rather hold the question of self-help preventive care in abeyance until I get through this. It raises somewhat different problems. And I have in mind now not self-help preventive care, but preventive care that would come through the medical system, either through public health measures that don't involve much of your cooperation any more than in the case of treatment. In the case of treatment and cure, you've got to cooperate too. He's saying that the benefits of treatment medicine are less than we normally think they are. Most of the benefits in longevity, increased longevity over the past centuries, are due to prevention. Okay. Now, what I want to argue is that, first I want to present the other case, the case for equivalence of prevention and treatment, rather than a priority for cure and treatment. And then I want to come back and map out a qualified, because it makes distinctions about different kinds of care, a qualified case for the priority of treatment and cure. The case for equivalence, the moral case for equivalence, not only it can get more complicated than just emphasizing, a statistical life is not worth as much as an identifiable life. It needs to get more complicated because those people who deny the priority of treatment and cure and want to argue for equivalence, moral equivalence, are going to call into question the relevance of that statistical identifiable lives distinction. They'll just go back to the original point. What's the difference in the outcome? Why should we care more about an identifiable life than a statistical life? It really is a life lost. In the end, it's just as much of a tragedy. So the case for equivalence then, the case for priority is not made good by simply emphasizing the statistical identifiable lives distinction, but that could get a lot more complicated. Let me jump to a different argument for equivalence and against the present American bias toward treatment. If we sat down right now, let's supposing none of us are in great trouble right now. If we sat down, if anybody sat down to organize a society, not knowing whether they're going to benefit from prevention, going to need a lot of treatment later or what, they would argue in their own self-interest, they would clearly argue for equivalence of the two. Not knowing whether they're going to be one of the people hit by a problem, they're certainly not going to be willing to put priority on treatment. They're just as likely to benefit from prevention as they are from treatment. They don't know which they're going to benefit from. Therefore, free people sitting down to adopt a healthcare system freely, rather than just being locked into one that came to us with certain political institutions, would in their own self-interest insist on the equivalence of prevention and treatment. And therefore, finally, what the case for priority, the present arrangement, comes down to is simply having to put up with less than optimal institutions that we're stuck with. Now, I think that argument is wrong. The reason I think it's wrong is just right, goes right back to the reduction in risk cases. The whole discussion gets going because we wonder what money should be spent on healthcare and whether dollars spent here should be spent there. So you get into the price of life discussion and trade-offs in the use of resources here, resources there right away. Now, if we really look carefully at that price of life discussion, what I would argue is that what all the empirical data seem to show is something like this. If you are confronted with a 1 in 10,000 risk, suppose you pay $10, suppose you as an individual would pay $10 to reduce it to zero. That computes out to $100,000 per life saved. As I said yesterday, you certainly get that if you look at it as a whole community of 10,000 people, each paying $10, adopting a certain program, and as a result, statistical likelihood is if one life will be saved, you had $100,000 in which to operate the program. If you ask that same person who made this decision, not to spend $11, but definitely to spend 9 or 10, what they would pay to reduce a 50% risk to their life. I'm not talking about 1 year of life. I'm talking about their life. Typical person. Their whole life. 50% chance that they'll forgo the rest of their life. What will they pay? Assuming they can borrow, call on resources, they can get other people. Clearly, people would be willing to go up at least to figures like this. And if they're willing to go up to anything close to that, they're going to be up in the five, they're going to be way over $100,000 in the per life saved calculation. Now what that means is simply that if you compute it out per life saved, people are willing to pay more per life saved in high risk situations to reduce a big risk than they are to reduce a very small risk. Now that sounds counterintuitive in a way. What it means is that the actual monetary price of life varies with the circumstances in which it's threatened. Life does not have just an objective value set for once and all. It varies with the particular circumstances of a person's life. It is greater in high risk situations than it is in low. The monetary price of life. I don't mean the rest of the value of life. I mean the monetary price. Now if that's the case, then, if I'm sitting here now, not knowing whether I'm more likely to benefit from prevention or from an emphasis on treatment, I know that my life, if it's later threatened by a high risk, is going to be more valuable to me in monetary terms. I know that already, even though I don't know whether I'll be threatened. Okay? I know that I'll be willing to pay more per life saved if I'm hit with a problem later than I am if I'm just trying to decide on a prevention program. Because of that, I now know, even though I'm not yet hit, I now know that my life is worth more in high-risk situations. Because I know I'll value it more, monetarily. And that means that even now, I would be willing to shift some resources away from the equivalence allocation, where we assign them strictly according to the results they produce, away from prevention and toward treatment. Even though, this is the counterintuitive, but I think justifiable part of it, even though by so doing I am reducing my chances of living, by shifting away from more efficient prevention to less efficient treatment, because I acknowledge the higher monetary price on life in high-risk situations, I am actually now reducing my chances of living. But I will do it. I will do it simply once we see what the monetary valuation of life business is, namely what people are actually willing to pay in the circumstances. We'll get a case for some priority for treatment. So this is not just a moral emotion. It is something connected with calculated self-interest. Although it doesn't look that way. Right. Even if there isn't a liberty difference, even if emphasis on prevention doesn't encroach on my individual liberty any more than emphasis on treatment does, even if there is no difference in terms of liberty, this argument says we would, in our self-interest, still put a priority on treatment. It wouldn't be that great a priority because the difference here isn't between zero and a million. The difference is, a factor of four or five. So maybe we should spend five times as much per year of life saved or for life saved on kidney dialysis, assuming that, than on this screening test for cervical cancer. Even though the screening test for cervical cancer there are no liberty differences between the two. So. Now, you add to that case for an emphasis on treatment the further observation that not all, but certainly a lot of prevention programs, if emphasized in the wrong way, would encroach on liberty, or at least require me to increase my responsibility somehow. And then you maybe get an even stronger case for a self-interested person saying ahead of time, no, I like the present arrangement. Although maybe it goes a little too far, I like the basic idea of it. Huh. So you get down to the real low risks and are at risk averse at all?
Yeah, the real low risk.
Okay.
Sure.
Oh. But wouldn't almost everybody pay something? It drops here. As the risks get low, it drops sharper. It drops more than in a straight line. It drops like this. But still, if there's some risk and it can be removed, no matter how small it is, wouldn't people pay something? Even if it's a penny added to their taxes. Okay, I'm talking about people who aren't yet in trouble. People sitting down rationally at the beginning of life, let us say, trying to assess what kind of healthcare system they want for their society, are not yet in trouble. So the prevention is not likely to benefit them further down the pike than the treatment. Yeah. It would explain this difference, health. It'd make this difference perhaps more extreme. However, just know, the more extreme it gets, the stronger the case for the current emphasis on treatment and de-emphasis on prevention. Even though, by so doing, we are saving less lives. This whole argument is a matter of saying the numbers don't count completely. They get discounted by other considerations. Marty? Sure. Okay, also, I don't want to get politically polemical about this at all, because I'm not saying this from a right-wing perspective, but if you had a National Health Service and it wanted to save federal budget dollars, clearly it's going to adopt equivalence as its basic moral assumption, because it wants to minimize the number of lives saved and minimize the number of people who get in trouble and then cost a lot of money and are going to hospitals. But maybe that moral case, maybe there's not a moral case for that, even though there clearly is a budgetary case for the federal government. They would cover screening programs that are not currently covered. They would have instituted this screening test for cervical cancer for women between 30 and 45. Just like immunization clinics or what? It's a question of how much you emphasize it. And if you had emphasized it, you would have actually gotten more bang for your buck than with a lot of present uses of money in the medical system. And yet we passed it up. We didn't emphasize it. If it were... Oh, no, it wouldn't be compulsory. It would just be emphasized and aggressively promoted. Yeah. We might not be talking... We aren't necessarily talking about compulsory programs. But we're talking about aggressively promoted ones.
Yeah. That's part of the correcting for the foolishness and lack of imagination and the political bias, which is not the legitimate moral part of the emphasis on treatment, but something illegitimate. I agree. There's a lot of correcting that has to go on. But I don't want to see us operating on the assumption that a person who's in trouble, the dollar value of a person's life who's in trouble, is worth only the same amount of money as the dollar value of a person's life that isn't in trouble. It might be saved by prevention. I think the former, is worth more, monetarily. And that's simply a self-interest. That's simply looking at people's preferences. The reason I come back to this, the theological reasons, it fits in the theological context. I don't want to say that God cares more about the life that's saved by crisis medicine than that God cares about the life of the person saved by preventive medicine. It's precisely the fact that God doesn't care more for one than the other that leads us to be ardent advocates of equivalence between prevention and crisis medicine. But I think, though that's true, still, once God cares equally for both, human beings can make choices about what they care about most. And human beings care more about their lives in terms of willingness to spend money in crisis situations than they do in preventive situations, even after stress is for ignorance to do it. Okay, there's another argument that I think, let me get on to one other argument because it has a very interesting implication for some local decisions that hospitals might make. There's another argument here for emphasis on treatment, cure over prevention, some emphasis. By the way, a great difficulty in all this is trying to tell us how much emphasis there is to get putting on. I think there's a way we can play around with that, but it gets complicated in arithmetic. One of the things that would be unfair if we made prevention equivalent to treatment is that though everybody starting out now who doesn't know into which category they're going to fall, a person benefited by prevention or a person who's going to be hit by a crisis, though all those people would benefit by a policy of equivalence, maybe it would be discounted some by this argument so you get some priority for treatment. Still, some people actually in their lives never have the chance of benefiting from a policy of making prevention equivalent to treatment. The reason is they're ill now. Either now in our political system where we're trying to just fashion a new healthcare system, they're 40 years old and ill. Or even if we got over that problem and somehow started and said, well, for people born from now on, prevention is going to be equivalent to treatment, and only for those who are already sick will treatment have priority. And then you phase people in over a generation. Even if you did that, there are congenital illnesses. And the congenitally ill person never has a chance of benefiting as much from a policy of equivalence as from a policy of crisis, some priority for crisis treatment. Therefore, treatment of congenitally ill people has priority over prevention, even if all the other arguments for prevention work. Okay? Now you'll say, aha, aha, what that means is we should load up the neonatal intensive care units for defective infants. That's our first priority. We should be spending a lot more per life saved there than we should on prevention programs. No, doesn't follow. It doesn't follow for the same diseases that you find in the neonatal intensive care unit. This is an actual decision that occurred in the Tacoma area in the last 2 years. People had to decide whether to expand, whether to grant, and a certain board had a regional health systems agency, had to decide whether to approve the proposal by two hospitals in Tacoma to expand the neonatal intensive care unit, both of the neonatal intensive care units. That board could have said no, because we're not spending nearly enough in terms of lives saved for money spent on education in the public schools to prevent people from having children in the circumstances where they're likely to be defective children, for example. But it didn't. It approved the neonatal intensive care unit expansion. Now, I would argue that even though, I would argue two things in that case. The defective infants, congenitally ill when born, have priority over your and my preventive care. They have no priority over future infants with congenital illness. And therefore, prevention of future congenital illnesses is just as important as crisis treatment of present congenital illness. Though crisis treatment of present congenital illness does have priority over prevention of non-congenital illness, yours and mine. I think one has to be very careful about some different distinctions here. And I think it is pathetic indeed that we're spending as much money on neonatal intensive care units as we are, when we're spending as little money as we are on some of the programs to educate people about the ways to avoid birth defects, which do not necessarily involve abortion, if you don't want to get into that moral controversy. There are a lot of other things, too. Okay, that's the end of my... Let me just add one comment about the business of holding people responsible when they abuse themselves by not using prevention on themselves. They don't go to the doctor to get some little screening test, they smoke, or whatever. I think it was done, does not follow from the fact that they've abused their responsibilities that we shouldn't care for them once they get in trouble. What does follow is that if we could do it practically, and fairly, though there are big problems about that, we should put the extra costs of the treatment that they incur that they otherwise wouldn't have incurred on them, which means we would have a smoker's tax. First thing we would do is remove the subsidy for tobacco. And for sugar, there's also a major big subsidy on sugar growers. We wouldn't necessarily remove it. We would just make the smokers and the sugar eaters pay for it. There's nothing wrong with the subsidy if the people who are using the thing pay for it. The problem with that, however, is we don't know what category of things to pick out. If we could just pick out the ones that were harmful, as distinct from the ones that weren't, we'd do it. But we just don't know how harmful, and it's a lot of practical considerations that have led us not, I think, to do that. But theoretically, if in fact our science gets better about what is harmful, the distinction between harmful and non-harmful behaviors, I'm all in favor of taxes. I'm not in favor of denying treatment. Somebody who hasn't asked so far. Nyla?
Yeah,
The bell's going to ring any minute. So. OSHA made one very bad mistake. It got all the libertarian people in the Reagan administration, including a lot of intellectuals like Milton Friedman, mad as hops about OSHA. OSHA said that because of its legislative congressional mandate, it was charged with preserving safety in the workplace, regardless of cost. But to preserve safety in the workplace, regardless of cost, is an insult to you and me, who might very well not want to pay $1,000 extra for a car just because it's safer. Or workers don't necessarily want to sacrifice wages just in order to have a safer workplace, et cetera. And the figures coming out, the critics of OSHA have some very cogent arguments. They cite programs that OSHA has mandated, which OSHA knew were going to cost $4 million for life saved, and still went ahead and mandated. They're, if you want to call it Milton Friedman's term, is their safety ideologues. Now, if they just hadn't made that mistake, if they had just been willing to consider the price of life business, then they could have marked, they would never have been open to that criticism. That's right. That's right. They've done a lot of good things. They've saved a lot of lives at the tune of 20,000 for life's sake. And that is not only a goodbye, it's reprehensible when we don't spend that money.